This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. Before I get to my guest, who is the amazing writer, Rachel Howard, I want to share a little update on this podcast, and thank you for listening. My guest is Rachel Howard, who writes fiction, nonfiction, essays, memoir, and dance criticism. Her memoir is called The Lost Night, and her new novel is called The Risk of Us, which tells the story of a couple who begin fostering a troubled 7-year-old girl and are faced with the decision to move toward permanent adoption or not. The Risk of Us looks at the challenges this couple face as they navigate parenthood and how fostering impacts their individual identities and shared relationship. The novel is told in spare language, fraught with emotion, as the couple who is unnamed go through a year of lives with Marisa, their foster daughter. Howard herself adopted a daughter from the foster system in California, an experience which informed her novel. We began the discussion with Howard sharing her thoughts about the impetus of The Risk of Us.
I was in the adoption and foster care world because we took in a girl when she was 7. And I do remember one day I saw a brochure like the one that's mentioned in the book in a lobby. And it said something about, we need families that take risks. And that phrase just really struck me because I thought, who advertises for families that take risks? Like, in what other context is that a quality that you're looking for in potential parents? There was a moment, I think, when it clicked for me that adopting someone in this way, and also a child being adopted in this way, that it's a lot like a marriage, and that you hope that the feelings are unforced on both sides, but there's a tremendous pressure getting there.
What made you decide that this needed to be fiction? Because you had experience with memoir before.
Yeah, that was actually immediate, that decision. Really part of the initial conception of the book, that I felt like I had seen so much advocacy, and advocacy is crucial. So much advocacy is needed in foster care right now for lots of topical reasons I could get into, with the number of children in foster care rising 5 years in a row. More are sure to enter now because of what's unfortunately continuing to happen at the border with the separations from families. And I had seen advocacy, and I was in the world, so I was seeing a lot of brochures, and I was seeing a lot of parenting advice books, and I felt like what fiction does is create this space that removes all judgment. It's just a space for being curious, for not having the answers, and for just looking really closely at hard questions. And that's how I wanted to treat this subject. I wanted people to come to a subject, you know, when we're dealing with foster care and the pressures of parenting and children who desperately need parents, there's so much on the line for everyone. And there's so much in our human nature that's an urge to judge. And the narrator of the novel is aware of this urge herself. An urge to say, well, it must not have worked out with the previous foster parents because they didn't try hard enough, or they weren't committed enough. And she learns a hard lesson over the course of the book where she's pushed to the limit, and suddenly she doesn't think of herself as so different from the previous foster parents who tried. So I just wanted to create a space where judgment was not the point, and really difficult things could be just looked at.
There is an element of this novel where it does read like a memoir, and it's hard to exactly put my finger on it. It's definitely intimate, but I've read intimate novels. I mean, part of it is you use the second person a lot, saying you, referring to both the husband and the daughter. But I think there's something more. And maybe that has to do with you started your notes in a journal, but I don't know. And I'm just wondering, you know, when I finished this and I turned it over, I had to see the word a novel again to remind me, because I was swept away in it as if it was so real.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was definitely aware of working with that ambiguity. So the voice, which you're pointing to, that I think creates a lot of that quality, was very important to me. That was sort of the second big moment in the conception of the novel, was when I was driving down to San Francisco for a party with other authors, actually. And this woman speaking to her husband, the voice came to me, actually came to me in those opening sentences. And I knew that if I could get it down right away, I would have the tone and that I could ride that voice through the whole book. But that if I didn't get it down, I would lose the whole book. So I got to the party and ran inside. And even though there were already people there socializing and having wine and whatnot, I went into a closet and wrote for a couple of hours. And in hindsight, the reason that voice works really well is, you know, it's something that poets use a lot. Seen this kind of address seen less frequently in fiction, but I had also been reading Jenny Offel's Department of Speculation, which starts out with an address to a you, the narrator of the novel speaking to her husband. So that surely was in the back of my mind. Puts the reader in this space of, instead of being spoken to, you know, just eavesdropping on an intimate conversation. And so I think it has this odd effect of giving a little bit more room for the reader to not be pressured. They're not being asked to believe anything or have any certain reactions, and also let them lean in a little closer because they're hearing a conversation that they're eavesdropping on.
So let's talk a little bit about the book. We have this couple that in the beginning are childless. They are kind of looking for the kid that they want to take in. And she sees an exhibit at her church and sees photos of these kids. And it was instinctual that she chose this child. Then they were kind of off to the races and they got this young girl, 7 years old, Marisa.
The couple in their 40s, and they've been married a handful of years and decided that they wanted to do this together. And the first line is, it starts with a face in a binder, children available, reads the cover. In the real California foster system, if you are trying to raise a child in this way, you work with a nonprofit agency and you can go into their office and look through these huge plastic binders of flyers of children who need homes and see their pictures and a little bit of information, pretty protected, but a little bit of information about their background and their interests. And then you inquire about meeting them. And yes, for the couple in the novel, this is one of the first flyers that they see. And they see this girl, Marisa, and they note right away, there's just something about her that once seems like it's just flying right off the page with her energy and her spirit. And they note that they're highly interested in her, and that's the first child that they meet.
It seems like it's so risky to say families who are willing to take risks, right? Because you, like, in some ways, you could be a family that likes to take risks where you're like, let's not have any money anymore. Let's sell everything and travel the world. Or they could be families that do drugs. Like, risk is so many ways. And you said in real life, you saw this flyer and it was also in the book. So I'm wondering if you can talk about that and then the family you created.
I wish I had the flyer still. I don't have the real flyer that I saw, but that's exactly what struck me. It's like, what kinds of risks are we talking about taking? And when you go into making this kind of family, and also for the couple in the book, you know, they go to a lot of training. They go to some trainings, and you get some leveling from the social workers that there will be challenges, but it's necessarily very abstract, right? It's hard to wrap your head around, well, the child is going to have trauma and trauma-induced reactions, and, you know, there will be panic attacks and there will be tantrums and There's going to be a period of you all testing each other, you know, and you're going to have to make it through that period. But that's so, it's so abstract till the person's really right there in front of you. And that's what it's like for the couple in the book.
You don't usually end up in the foster care system because you had a happy home life. And with their child, she was separated from her sister. There was abuse for her. There was some of sexual abuse. Her mom was in jail. So you're getting this child that is so traumatized, and it's such a balance between setting boundaries and giving them love. And you see the parents really struggling with that. And I'm wondering if you can talk about writing those scenes, because you're trying to sort of mitigate the pain and show the beauty. And it's a balance, just like it probably is in real life.
I would say it was a dialectical process for me writing this book. So, you know, I really believe that you know things by what they are not. So, you know, truth in the face of untruth. And so for me in this book, the first full draft was writing against sentimentality and being in touch with this state of not knowing, that these three people do not know whether they're going to make it as a family. And to keep myself in that state as I wrote scene to scene. And if I was just in that state of mind with each of them, then the details of the scenes would bring the reader also into that state. As I wrote the first draft, I did not know which way the turn would go for these three people. I did not know if they were going to make it or not when we got to that point. But in the first draft, I was selecting the things that cut against the sentimentality. And then in the second draft, I had to build in all of the things where the wife and the husband and the daughter are connecting with each other, and the really moving moments and the joyful moments, to let a little bit more of that in.
One of the things that really struck me was the big team of support that they had, that was very optimistic and hopeful. I think that the state, and this took place in California, was so supportive, knowing like to take on a foster kid that may have had abuse and issues in her past. We know that you can't do it alone. So here are all the things we want to offer you. And I'm wondering if you could talk about all the characters that were kind of there helping the parents along, and maybe that in the book and then that in your life.
Yeah, that was a central impetus for the book, because I mean, really a big part of the reason this book was burning for me, and I felt right away like, I can make this a novel, this can work as a novel, was the intensity of all of the surveillance in this intimate situation, and knowing that it was important that all this surveillance was there, shouldn't be gotten rid of. It's, you know, it's the best hope to have all of these people watching and putting in their advice and, looking out for the child. You know, even if your family has gone through an FBI background check and be interviewed, like they need to keep an eye on this. But then at the same time, it's, intensely uncomfortable for particularly the mother in this story. The husband can kind of shake it off more. The social agencies, of course, want them to finalize. They want this to be the child's final home. At the same time, that's not guaranteed. This is ultimately going to go to the court with all of these people reporting on it. So there's a social worker who does their home study and interviews the couple. And she's called the gray-crowned social worker in the book. And there's another social worker from the far-off county that the girl moves from. And he's called Surfer Dude. And he's much more laid back. And the wife and the husband kind of like him and are a little bit more comfortable with him. But he's not the one who's the main player. It's the gray-crowned social worker who is a little more skeptical of them, I think, because she's just on overdrive trying to do her job well. And she's the one who's closer and dropping in on them all more often. And then there is a therapist, which they're first assigned from County Behavioral Health, that at first the adoptive mother is hoping that this woman's a great fit. And that becomes very uncomfortable. And then it's difficult for her to take charge of being Marisa's mom and to say, you know, I know what this little girl needs. She's living with me and I feel I know her the best. You all just drop in on her once a month or once a week and say, we're going to change therapists. That's kind of a central thing that that the narrator and the husband, Sebastian, have to get over here to really be Marisa's parents.
What about your experience?
Oh, my experience was very much like that. probably that's the most intensely corresponding to reality element of the novel. Yes.
Well, I mean, you must feel in some ways you're in a fishbowl because it is a double-sided interview in some ways. I mean, it's that you have to decide if you want this life, but then people have to decide if you're worthy of this life. And you must feel so tender and delicate, like if you make one mistake, that must feel like there's so much at risk.
Yeah. And also because relationships are being managed in lots of different directions. So you can get the parents get caught in a war between different factions at one point. And they're trying to just keep all of the factions happy that another worker, not even the therapist, but then there's this adjunct to the therapist called the family support specialist. And she's gone and done a school observation and learned that one day when Marisa ran off from the classroom, the first grade teacher went off after her and picked her up and carried her back. And that sends up for her a red flag. Oh, no, no, teachers are never supposed to touch the child. He shouldn't have picked her up and carried her back. And the couple, the narrator and Sebastian, are you know, the school has been their saving grace and their greatest support in this process. And so they are terrified about pissing off the school. And, you know, now being pressured by the therapist, the family support specialist and the social worker that they need to call the superintendent's office and make a big stink out of this. And then meanwhile, you have surfer dude from the far off county and he's stepping in and going, oh, no, 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 they've completely overstepped their bounds. They should never have told you that you have to call in the superintendent's office. And don't worry, I'm the one who makes the decisions about where Marisa will live. Which is not exactly comforting because then you realize, well, okay, well, they may not have all this. He's saying they don't have all this power, but he's the one who has all this power. Well, what happens if we do something to his displeasure? So, yeah, they are all caught in quite a web together. And that's why I thought there's a book in this, because even though it's intimately about these three people trying to make it together, trying to come to a place where they're bonded and they do unconditionally love each other, it's also about a tough problem in society. And this is all our societal problem that, you know, we need to set up these systems to help kids as well as we can. And that's difficult to do, which also points to, I mean, this is what I love about fiction, right? That it can hold really hard truths that might seem contradictory, might seem like you need to choose between these truths, but you don't. They coexist. And here that's, you know, okay, we need families that will take in children who are in foster care and be able to succeed. We need to support those families. But foster care should be a last resort, and we should do everything we can to just not have these kids in the system to begin with, because look how difficult it is to construct an administrative system, a bureaucracy that can, you know, respond to individual humans. So I thought those are questions for a novel.
Yeah. And so basically the way that it it works is, you know, you get to decide when you want to finalize it. I mean, on some level, the parents could say, okay, we're ready. We want to go for it. Or they could say, hey, we want to wait. But it seemed like there was like a delicate dance because they don't want to, they couldn't wait too long. But during that period before they were ready to sort of name a date, they had some real doubts that had to do with Marisa's emotional issues, that had to do with how she was reacting to them, that had to do with if they felt like they were up to the task of raising a child that was this complicated. And to me, that was kind of the crux or the sort of the crescendo of all of this, like where it was all moving to was, do they do this or not?
I mean, I don't think I'll ever have an experience writing a book like this again. And I have another novel that I worked on for 7 years before I started on this one. But yeah, when this one came to me, I knew how to make it work because I knew this child is going to come live with them. And then, okay, there's 6 months mandatory limbo in within the system. That's how the system is set up. The child has to be in a placement for 6 months. After that, theoretically, it's open to finalizing the adoption. If the courts sign off, if everything goes well bureaucratically, and if the family is ready. And so I thought, okay, she's going to come live with this family and there's serious time pressure here. They're either going to make it or they're not. And that's what's going to contain the book and drive the tension of it. So after they make it through that mandatory 6 months, it's what they thought would have been an easy kind of counting down on the clock is much more complicated. And I will say from my experience in the system in real life and knowing lots of other families, that unfortunately, you know, you'd think, okay, well, you know, whatever family takes in a child is going to make the ultimate commitment as quickly as possible. Sadly, that does not always happen. There are children who go on in limbo with families who aren't sure if they want to commit for a long time. And I personally know a children who have been with a family for 2.5 years. And all of a sudden, for subtle reasons, they say, no, they're not going to make the commitment. And the child moves on to a new home. And what happens is heartbreaking. The bureaucratic reality of the system is that a family that has a foster child, even if they've entered the system saying they want to offer permanency and this is their goal, can at any time call a 7-day notice. And so with 7 days, that child moves on to a new home.
I think the novel also looks at the question of unconditional love, and most parents would say it's unconditional love, but every once in a while there is conditional love, and it feels maybe easier when you're taking on someone and you're assessing if they fit in your family to have conditional love, right? You know, these people are taking her in, and if she isn't too hard or too violent, then they can take her in.
So I personally am very influenced by a preacher at the Episcopal Cathedral where I converted. I grew up with no religion and became very religious, well, although it was a gradual kind of process, but in my 20s. And the preacher there, Alan Jones, talked a lot about, you know, what if love isn't about sentimentality? What if love is a policy? It's not the feelings, it's a policy. If you have the feelings, great. But but always, always act with love as the policy. And then that gets into a more interesting idea of love than I think that we're used to in this culture, which is a discussion that I would like to open up and be delighted if the book did open up. Because we get into this tribalism of kind of love for the people nearest to us and for children, right, that we think needs to be this intense attachment. And that's our kind of go-to idea of love. But, you know, what if love is just desire for the best interest of everyone, you know, whether or not you have that intense attachment to them. And that makes for more complicated decisions. It's a spiritual challenge.
Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer?
Yeah, so it's called Voyage in the Dark by Jean Rhys. And the narrator of the book, the main character, Anna, she's 19, and she's a chorus girl in England. And she's had to move there from the Caribbean. And her father has died, and she's just got a stepmother somewhere else in England who really doesn't want anything to do with her. And she's just been kind of throwing herself at men. And she has this lover who picked her up in one of the towns where she was touring as a chorus girl, and his name is Walter. And the problem is at first she was very wary, but now she really is starting to feel very tenderly towards him, although she doesn't quite want to admit that to herself. So she's going on a visit to him, and she can feel him already starting to pull away. The taxi stopped, and I got down and paid the man and went into the hotel. He was waiting for me. I smiled and said, "Hello." He had been looking very solemn, but when I smiled like that, he seemed relieved. We went and sat in a corner. I said, "I'll have coffee." I imagined myself saying very calmly, "The thing is that you don't understand. You think I want more than I do. I only want to see you sometimes, but if I never see you again, I'll die. I'm dying now, really, and I'm too young to die." The candles crying wax tears and the smell of stephanotis, and I had to go to the funeral in a white dress and white gloves and a wreath round my head, and the wreath in my hands made my gloves wet. They said, "So young to die." The people there were like upholstered ghosts. I said, "That letter I had from Vincent." "I knew he was writing," he said, twisting his head a bit. "You asked him to write?" "Yes, I asked him to write." When he talked, his eyes went away from mine, and then he forced himself to look straight at me, and he began to explain, and I knew that he felt very strange with me and that he hated me, and it was funny sitting there and talking like that, knowing he hated me. One thing I really love about this passage is that bit in the middle about the candles crying wax tears. There's her memory floating in of her father's funeral from her time in the Caribbean, and she intercuts those, you know, so boldly. It's a really risky technique to take on in a novel. And then this line, "The people there were like upholstered ghosts." The rhythm of it. I know it's strange, like a random, but you know how when you're a younger writer and you read a work that really gets to you, and then there's just one line like that that may have some really random content, but the music of it stays with you. And it's the music that ends up being influential on your own style.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was something tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft.
All right. So this is a passage that I wrote and rewrote a lot up to the 11th hour. The narrator is speaking to the little girl, and the context here is that the narrator's husband, Sebastian, who's trying to become Marisa's father, has an atrial septal heart defect. So his physical health is delicate. All right. "Here's something I can't say to you, little one, because I'm not sure you'd understand. It's easy to take the wrong way. Reason number one, I married Daddy. I knew he was going to die. I mean, viscerally understood this, which meant he was a real person, not an abstraction in my imagination like all the other men I feared would either leave, like my fantasy father, or stray and become flawed. Less than perfect for me, in some impossible to predict way. I can't explain how this hit me, how, for the first time, I got it. This weird, kind man wouldn't be here forever. He was a real person, simultaneously precious and imperfect, like me. which meant my own selfish fears were finally moot.
Tell me why you chose that.
This was a passage that people questioned me on consistently from the first draft of this novel, because it's a surprising thing for the narrator to say, I married him because I knew he was going to die, and obviously begs for some explanation. And the explanation is really complex for this narrator, this woman. She's had a lot of lovers in between her first husband that it didn't work out with and Sebastian, who she calls daddy. And there was a panic for her in committing to someone that she hasn't understood. And I had to drill down and try to understand it myself to make this passage work. In earlier drafts, I had it being about her fear that a man who seemed really nice and felt like she could have a relationship with, that he would become a thug, that if she risked giving herself, he would actually be a bad person. And then I realized, like, no, that was an issue for her sometimes, but that's not the core of the panic that she would have in committing to someone here. And then I finally got down to, like, okay, well, what it is actually is that when you're holding yourself in a little bit of reserve from committing to someone, then that person can be more of the fantasy. And you're not really up against all the flaws that are going to come in. So then that helped crack it open. But then I got to a draft where I had, he was a real person, simultaneously precious and ordinary, was what it said. And that's what I sent off in one of the final passes. It was supposed to be the final pass with the copy editor, who was incredible, by the way. I cannot believe how closely I got to collaborate with the copy editor at Houghton Mifflin, whose name was Larry. So we sent it off with, he was a real person, simultaneously precious and ordinary. And then I thought on that, and it just hit me at 2 a.m. It's not about someone being ordinary. It's just imperfect, and that we're all imperfect. And so it may seem like a tiny thing, but it was a huge thing for me, because to me, like, to reject somebody because they're ordinary is, like, I don't know, really, it's not wouldn't be the most flattering characteristic of this narrator. All that, you know, she has plenty of unflattering characteristics, but I realized that wasn't even true for her. It was just that we're all imperfect.
Where do you write?
I have an office. I used to write on our back porch, but now I've started a small writing studio here in my town where I teach writing classes. And so I found a place that had a conference center that you got to use for free if you just rented one of the smaller offices within the building. So I go to downtown Grass Valley, and it's an, I think, 1850s building that's been subdivided into therapist rooms and yoga studios. And next to me is a massage therapist. And my little room has a nice window, and the floors are really old and really beat up. I wonder what kind of factory was there in the 1850s. It's supposed to have internet in the building, but the internet never works. And the landlady keeps telling me that I should let her know when it's out, but I stopped because I realized it was so useful to have a place where I couldn't count on the internet. So I go there because there's no internet, and I don't want the landlady to know.
What do you do, or where do you go to get away from writing?
I'm never trying to get away from writing. I'm always trying to get to writing. So I can't imagine trying to get away from it. I'm just, you know, always having to block out and strategize my days to make the time no matter what. It's always such a fight, and I can't live without it. And if I go more than 3 days with working on a project, not journalism or, you know, writing emails, but doing some kind of writing that's really personal to me, then I start to go kind of crazy. So I'm never trying to get away.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
I have a writer's group here in town of two other writers, and we meet every other week, which is one person up at a time. So every 6 weeks, I get to have something read by them. And then the other thing I did, I realized like 4 years ago that I was really stuck in my writing and just needed complete outside perspective. And someone had told me about the, you know, the service Fiverr where you hire people to do things for you. And I just went on there and like looked through editors and tried out five different Fiverr editors and found this guy in England. I won't dare share his name because if other people start booking him, I don't know what I'll do. when I have something really wild and new, I send it to him and pay his Fiverr fees to get his feedback on it.
How have you dealt with rejection?
That's a really hard question because it's so different in each. I mean, there's so much rejection, but it's so different how it hits you depending on the context. So I say mostly I just take it like anyone else. You know, I've got my submittable dashboard with, God, I don't even want to know the real number of pieces on there that are marked declined. And then there's like three that are marked accepted. So rejections are coming into me via the little submittable emails every week. And mostly, you know, just self-talk about, you know, it's a subjective experience of people reading your work. And this is what it's like for all writers out there. You can't think it's just you. This is, we're all going through this.
And what is your favorite word?
My favorite word is deliquescent, which I never use in my writing, never found the opportunity, but I also write dance criticism, and longtime critic who mentored me, whose work I love, I saw him use it in a dance review. He was describing a dancer's plié and he described it as deliquescent, which I had to look up, and it means that something is given to turning to liquid. I think of that all the time, and it never quite feels natural in my writing, but I'd love to hold that word in my brain.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing. My guest was Rachel Howard, author of The Risk of Us. Our interview was recorded at Aspen Public Radio. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft, a dialogue on writing and click like, and on Twitter at First Draft APR. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. Thanks so much for tuning in. As a reminder, please consider supporting First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. I'm committed to continuing the show, and your support will help me do that. Thanks again for listening and supporting First Draft. Please tell a friend, a reader, a writer to tune in. I'm Mitzi Rapkin.